morning. This is Scott Wheeler, the host of the Vermont Voice, a program of 1490 AM WIKE in Derby. The Vermont Voice is brought to you today by the generous sponsorship of the Orleans Essex Visiting Nurses Association and Hospice, providing more than 40 years of quality, compassionate home care in the Northeast Kingdom. Our guest this morning is Bea Nelson of Derby. She's here to talk about the Abenaki Indians of Orleans County. Good morning, Bea.
Good morning.
So we're here to talk about the Abenaki. Can you start just by giving a brief history of the Abenaki in Vermont?
They've always been here. There's plenty of archaeological evidence to show that they've been here since the last ice age. The glaciers retreated, and there've been evidence of presence.
Now, when you say a presence, did they live throughout Vermont, or was this, you know, back when I was in school? You know, I graduated from high school in 1984, and I believe I was still being taught by some teachers what we now know as a myth. You know, I was taught that Native Americans just passed through this area. Now, why was I being taught that when basically there's a lot of people I understand even understood back then that wasn't true?
Yes, back when the early settlers came, they didn't want to say that somebody already lived there, so that they claimed that the Native Americans were just passing through, that nobody really lived here. People like Ethan Allen and Ira Allen and land speculators didn't want to settle in places or to grant lands to people sell lands to people if there was somebody living there, or if they just said that the Native Americans were living there. And because the Abenaki moved doing seasonal rounds and had only semi-permanent villages, and of course they didn't develop a village the way the white folks thought a village should be, then they claimed that nobody lived there, because if they were off to their fishing camps or their sugar camps or whatever, and there was nobody there at the time they arrived, then they claimed that no one lived there. And then that was just something that kept on, and of course the people that wrote history were the ones that wanted the land for themselves. Right. So,
do you think that was done on purpose to say that there wasn't any Native Americans here for land reasons, or do you think possibly that maybe sometimes they didn't understand the life of the Abenaki? When we think of a community, we think of a set location. Like if we think of Derby, you know, Derby and its people, you know, it stays there. But the Abenaki or the other Native American groups, they had a tendency to move around. Or do you think this was all on purpose?
It was a little bit of both. The Abenaki had seasonal rounds, but they had territories.
Right.
And families or family bands stayed within their territories and moved to different sections, so they wouldn't like overhunt or overfish in one particular area. But also Ethan Allen and Ira Allen both knew. I mean, he hunted and fished and lived near Abenaki and knew that they were here. So so did Ira Allen. And it's rumored that Ira Allen was married to a woman that had Native ancestry.
And you know, if you know even more than I do, that there's been a great deal of artifacts found in this region. And you know, if you're going to find one spear point, you have to figure there's many, many more, because, you know, the odds of finding that one is pretty slim. And you've worked with the state archaeologist Giovanna Peebles in helping map some of these finds. What have you seen over the years?
Well, I do know that in Derby and in Charleston and in Newport, there are semi-permanent villages. There are winter villages and summer villages that they went back to year after year. And in East Charleston or West Charleston, in Charleston, there is a permanent village where they stayed there for 10 full years. And hunted and fished in the area, but not very far away because of all the unrest that was going on around them during the French and Indian Wars and the War of 1812 and so on. But so it's a little bit of both. Some of it was done on purpose because the people knew that there were natives in the area and that lived there, and some of it was misunderstanding because they didn't realize how the Abnaki or other native tribes looked at the land. They figured they could not own land. They were only caretakers of the land. And when they did sign a grant or a sort of a treaty with a land company like Phillips Grant, there was no price. It was to take care of Philip and his two wives and to let his family band hunt and fish there in perpetuity.
You were involved with helping me identify a find that my daughter and her friend found back several years ago when they were just little girls. And that was really when I really got to know you. I remember bringing you this spear point, and I remember thinking, this spear point is so perfect. I didn't even think it was real. You know, when I think of a spear point, when I go to a museum, some things that they call a spear point or another artifact, I look at it and think, huh, looks like a rock to me. This one did not look just like a rock. And you looked at it, and I remember you saying, you know, like 8,000-9,000 years old, and, you know, a lot of spear points here, what, go 4,000-5,000? And I remember saying to you, Sobe, what have you been smoking? because, you know, that was a very old spear point. And
I wasn't sure of the age, but I knew it was old because it had the Clovis kind of groove. And that was during the Paleo-Indian period when they used that groove for hafting onto their spear, because at the time they hadn't started using bows and arrows yet. And so they used the atlatls, which was a spear thrower for their hunting. And anyhow, because of that groove, I thought it was a spear point, but I wouldn't dare say it was older than 8,000 or 9,000 years old, because I thought it might be a transition point between the Paleo period and the Archaic period, and I recommended that you show and ask Giovanna about it. And as it turned out, it was older than I thought.
Yeah, what, 10,000 to 12,000 years old? Yeah, Giovanna is, for anybody who hasn't met her, Giovanna is a one-of-a-kind. She's a state archaeologist, and she's like a person supercharged on 10 cups of coffee. And she has a true passion for what she does. And
her main focus is to educate the importance of archaeology and how to distinguish from if there's a find, that they can tell so much more from leaving it in place or from investigating around it than they can if somebody picks it up and brings it.
Right. And in reality, she was saying, too, is it isn't necessary the artifact that is the most important. It's the find in where you found it.
Exactly.
So if you do happen to pick up an artifact and you do insist on keeping it, is probably, would you say it's good to at least have it documented?
It's important that you show somebody. Like, people sometimes bring a piece to me and show me, because I consult with Giovanna and others, so it can be pinpointed. Because if it was a surface find, which there are some surface finds, there might be something else nearby. Documentation is important, because if there's a federal or a state project where they have to do an archaeological survey for Act 250, if there is a village or a site nearby, then they'll have to move the project or move it over, because it's part of the preservation to keep it intact in the situation that it's in. So with documentation at the state archaeologists, they document all the sites that have already been verified.
Yeah, I know my daughter's find has sure been documented. Giovanna came up and checked out the site, but it was also in U.S. News. And I just barely received a phone call in recent months from John Kroc, which you probably know him better than I. He's writing a book, and her find is also going to be in that book.
He's another archaeologist that teaches at UVM.
So what is the, you know, you see in the news a lot, Swanton. You know, you
can I just say one thing? That Paleo point that was found here in Derby is the oldest point that has been found in the Northeast Kingdom and in northern Vermont, right, other than in the Lake Champlain area.
For those of you just tuning in, our guest this morning is B. Nelson of Derby. So how come we have all this documentation here of Native American existence, well, in Orleans County, but we constantly hear about Swanton? Why is that?
Well, there are a lot of answers to that question, but Swanton has always had an Abnaki presence, because that's also where a lot of the archaeological surveys have been done around Lake Champlain, and that's where the history from Odinak and from Rogers Rangers and from all kinds of things, that there was a well-known Abnaki community in the Swanton area around the wildlife refuge, which is now the wildlife refuge, and there was a big village there, and that's also nearby where the University of Vermont is, and of course that the when they study the cultures, their archaeology and the sociology and the anthropology and the geology is all studied in the area around there, and that's how come so much is known. Also, since the 1970s, that's where a lot of the Abnaki resurgence or information has come out of, right, as far as that the Abnaki still exist and they're still here.
Right, because during my research as a chronicler of history, you know, wherever I look in the town records or town history books, you constantly find, or in diaries, you constantly find mention of the Abenaki presence here. I know I have a diary entry from the town of Jay, and the person is talking about their fear of the Native presence. In 1812, there was a large gathering of Native Americans on Owl's Head. I also find, I believe it was Troy, how there was an Indian doctress named Molly Ockett who helped the settlers basically weather the winter, but also helped a settler who was burned. So wherever I look in documents, the Native American presence seems to be real.
Both the Hemingway and the Charles Gazetteers, almost every town history that are in those gazetteers mentions Indian presence somewhere, and it was during the year of no summer, 1816, that Indian Joe here helped settlers in Derby learn how to feed themselves with things that they get foraged in the forest, like the Indians had done for years. It was the natives that taught the settlers how to make maple syrup, raise corn, do all kinds of things. In a lot of places, they lived together and worked together and hunted and fished together. Taught each other. And there are all kinds of stories of interaction.
Right. And while I have read things about the settlers being afraid of the Native Americans, like, for example, up on the Clyde Pond, there's a house that is near and 200 years old. It was built by Kelvin Arnold, who basically moved there because he saw the falls that were located there as a source of power. And he was one of the area's first settlers. And in one of the history books, it talks about when he moved there, the women folk were afraid of the Indians that were in that area. But I have never read anything about confrontations. You know, I've read about fear, but no were there confrontations here that you know of?
Not very many, no. Part of the fear was the fact that the stories were, because of the French and Indian Wars and because of the raids in the farther south in New England, and because of the Massachusetts, a lot of the settlers that came up came from Connecticut and Massachusetts and Rhode Island and New York. And they of course, were victims of a lot of the raids during the French and Indian Wars. And those wars were, the Abnaki fought mostly with the French, and they did raid those villages because those settlers had settled where Indian villages were, like in Newbury, Vermont. And they were had heard about or those raids. And so when they moved up here, even though the natives were a lot friendlier, and they were still had that fear that they were going to be scalped or whatever, tortured. And of course, you've got to remember that there was a lot of cruelty on both sides, right, during those times.
You know, we talk about the friendly relationship. Like, for example, the diary that was written by the man who is suspected of being the first person to explore Lake Mefremagog, when he arrived in the area, he writes about the large number of encampments along the way, and he stopped at some of them, and as they wrote, the men were out hunting moose and fishing for salmon. Now, I'm not quite sure if that was in this area or whether they had gone away, but the people left it back at the settlements were opened their doors to them. They fed them. They fed them. They allowed them to stay there. And
the first man that went up to Magog in that area got his canoe from the Indians and from Magog.
Right.
And Indian Joe, who when Timothy Hinman first came to Derby, he came and it was Indian Joe that helped him scout to build the roads that he built, and it was Indian Joe that also helped with the Bailey Hazen Road, which is famous here too, and the Hinman Settler Road. But Timothy Hinman had to go back to Danville where his family was after he had built his cabin, because his wife was sick and could not return for the winter, and his children were here. And when he came back, he was pleased to find that his children had been cared for by the band that lived at Derby Pond.
Right. For those of you just tuning in, our guest this morning is B. Nelson of Derby. Now, Vermont doesn't have a reservation for the Native Americans like other states do, so where did the Abenaki disappear to?
They actually hid in plain sight when it wasn't safe to be Native American because of the Indian Removal Act, and because even in the 1930s and 40s and 50s with the eugenics program, and a lot of them intermarried with the Anglos and with the French, and they lived in marginal areas, moved to the country and farmed or acted as guides or worked in the woods and hid in plain sight and assimilated.
So I have a couple lines in my family that includes Native Americans, but also I have English, French, and I believe Scottish. So what makes somebody a Native American? Am I an Abenaki, or am I a person with some Abenaki heritage?
Most of us are people with Abenaki ancestry, because the blood is kind of thin, and because of the intermarriage, and there are very few in Vermont full-blood Abenaki. And so most of us are a combination of all of the above.
I heard that there's a large percentage of us who have lived in Vermont for generations that have at least a certain amount of Abenaki blood.
They say that anybody above the 40th parallel whose families have been here for generations in northern Vermont, northern New Hampshire, or the eastern townships have enough blood to be on some tribal rolls.
Right.
Not necessarily on, and there are two reserves in Canada, in Odinak and Wolanak, and those are the closest reserves. Now, Missisquoi is the closest to a reserve that we have in Vermont, but it is not a reservation. And there's no way that the Abnaki in Vermont can have a reservation unless they purchase land, because there was no paperwork signed with the government, from government to government, like it was with the Iroquois.
Now, and they've had a lot in the news recently about the recognition of the Abenaki. How important is recognition for them?
It's very important for the state of Vermont to recognize the Abenaki, because for years, and in some places still do, say that they never lived here permanently, that they were just passing through, or that they were hunting and fishing through here. But with the sociologist and the anthropologist and the archaeologist and the geologist and the anthropologist, they all have pretty much decided that that's not so. And even right up while Governor Dean was saying the same thing, because he had put the fear into everybody that there would be land claims and there would be a casino, which is impossible. Because there were no papers signed and we can't have a reservation, there can't be a casino. A casino can only be built on a reserve, and it can only be built if the state legislature agrees to it. So there's no chance of either one. Because there were no treaties signed government to government, there's no way that we even can have land claims.
Now, do you think part of the issue with the whole recognition issue is that people basically have their idea of what an quote Indian looks like from watching TV is in Vermont, you know, as you were saying, is the blood has really been diluted. But do you think that's part of the problem when people look at a blonde-haired, blue-eyed person who says they're an Abenaki? Do you think that plays into, you know, what people perceive as Native American?
Oh, it does to a point. But it's really important that the state of Vermont recognize that the Abenaki are here. Only to correct history. And because so much was done with the out west,
right,
and that's what, and so much was written about, and movies were made, and all kinds of things about the Indians out west, that's what people think people, Indians are supposed to look like.
Right.
And it's a misinterpretation of what's native.
Right. Like, for example, is when you think of Indians or Native Americans, what's the first thing that come to most people's minds? They think of teepees. Teepees.
Abenaki didn't live in teepees.
Right.
That was only out west.
Right. And it's just like the long headdresses. Those weren't even.
No, they weren't. They were from the Plains Indians. The reason that Homer St. Francis, when he was chief, had one was because it was gifted to him by a Lakota Indian,
right,
and he was honored to wear it. Now, these other ones you see, unless they're from out west, shouldn't be worn as regalia.
Right. Now that we have recognition, now that the Native Americans have recognition in Vermont, what does it mean for the future of the Abenaki in Vermont?
Just a little respect for their culture and the fact that they can now share some of the family traditions and some of the traditions that have been continued within families usually, and that people think are family traditions, but actually a lot of them are the native traditions that have been carried through.
Now, the one thing is I've always turned to you and, you know, other folks like you for information, but with you, I have found that you take all politics and throw them out the door.
Try to.
Yeah, when I go to you, I know I'm going to get an answer to the best of your ability. And I really respect that. Now, how did you come about being interested in Native American issues?
Well, it wasn't until my aunt, who brought me up, was in her 90s that she would admit in public that we were Abnaki. But we had all kinds of family traditions that I wondered where they came from. And when I started doing genealogy, things weren't fit, like butternutting,
right,
or camping out to go berrying,
yeah,
or having big sugaring off parties in the sugar woods, and having willow whistles made by your uncle every time you went fishing in the spring, and spruce gum,
right,
and all kinds of things like that, and certain ways that the family did things. And so I started asking questions. And I have a cousin who looks very Native, actually. And her mother was always telling her, who was another aunt, was always telling her, well, you're a throwback. You're a throwback from before. You're a throwback. And that was in reference to the Native ancestry.
Right.
But they wouldn't say so until older in age.
So it sounds to me like you take pride in that part of your history.
Yes, I do, because a lot of the morals and a lot of the values are important.
Okay, the Abenaki now has recognition. What's the next step?
Oh, the next step is to make people aware and to teach awareness of the culture and to share some of the things that can be shared, and also to be able to sell our crafts as Abenaki made, because according to federal law right now, things can't be said Abenaki made but they can be with recognition, and they can be sold as Abenaki made. For a lot of things, education in school and to raise awareness and to let folks know that to change and correct history as it was written.
And I think just as important, as you'll agree, is...
And to teach the values.
Right. And to also maybe work a little harder at documenting the Abenaki history in the area the same way it has been done in other parts of the state.
Exactly. Especially local histories,
right,
because there's an awful lot of local history that is not written.
Okay.
Because a lot of it wasn't written by the local people.
Well, that's it. And now it's kind of up to us to try to rectify that.
Exactly.
So, well, Bea, it was great having you in today. And I, again, thank you for all your help over the years.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you for having me today.
Our guest this morning was Bea Nelson of Derby.
The Vermont Voice is brought to you today by the generous sponsorship of the Orleans Essex Visiting Nurses Association and Hospice, providing more than 40 years of quality and compassionate home care in the Northeast Kingdom.